CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. Fulton County, Georgia. The news is uniform. A grand jury charged Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and other Trump allies with operating a criminal enterprise that sought to overturn Joe Biden's electoral victory in Georgia. That was then. The new information continues that the Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is seeking an early trial date of March of 2024. Two different stories, the charge of the criminal enterprise and the political calendar of 2024, with Donald Trump clearly leading in the Republican field for the nomination for the presidency. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, to comment not only on these facts in the journal, but also a very happy conversation he had with Professor John Yu of Berkeley on the podcast that I recommend to everyone, Hoover does each week with Troy Sinek as the host, in which Richard and Professor Yu debate the merits of the Fulton County case, turning on the term RICO, with understanding that the center of RICO is a criminal act. The question here is, this enterprise, all these individuals around the former president, what was the criminal act at the center of this to invite RICO? Professor, a very good evening to you. Let's speak of a RICO. What does it mean? Good evening to you.
It's about racketeering, influence, and corruption. And they put the title RICO there to make sure that you understand you're going after the mafia and similar organizations. And this is back at a time when this was a very serious problem. And if you start looking at the requirements for RICO, it turns out that there's several. One is that you invest your money in an enterprise that does this. And another thing is you start to operate the enterprise. And then there's some sort of just general or take a stake in the enterprise. And then there's sort of dealing with the affairs of the enterprise. And that means you have to know what the enterprise is. So in this particular case, you're not dealing with a business enterprise. You're not dealing with a profit-making organization, which RICO is designed to deal with. You're dealing with political influence. So the centerpiece of this particular case has to be that the famous speech that took place on the telephone between Raffensperger, who is the Georgia Secretary of State at the time, and Donald Trump, was an effort to essentially bully this guy into committing some kind of an illegal act. What they then do in the indictment is engaged in an absolutely tedious recitation of various kinds of actions that were taken, which were part of this overt conspiracy. If you try to look for the definitions of what's the difference between a common law conspiracy on the one hand, where there are illegal means used to achieve illegal ends, and a RICO commission, it's very difficult to get the definition straight, but it's clear that you could reach wider under RICO and bring more people into the network with less information. The heart of the difficulty, as far as I can see, is courtesy of the New York Times. I went back and I read the discussion that Trump had with those people. And it seems to me that he was not asking that there be any illegal act committed. It is not sufficient when you're talking about criminal charges to take a single word, fine, as in fine me the votes, and to assume that what you're doing is asking somebody to be corrupt, that is to manufacture ballots, which would change the outcome. If you go back and you read the entire speech, it's Donald Trump's usual braggadocio on the one hand and self-pity on the other. And he says, you should have seen my rallies. I had so many more people than that Steve Biden. How could I have lost this election? And then what he says is, I'm sure there's some kind of irregularity. When I want you to find the votes, I don't want you to manufacture them. I want you to go back and to look at the situation to see whether the tally was correct. And then in typical Trumpian overstatement, he says, there were 5,000 dead people who voted. Raffensperger comes back and says, we did the count, then it was 2. And I'm not going to change that. And Trump's a little bit flows, but, you know, he's never going to quit. Says, find him somewhere else. So then the question is, how does this start to play out? Binding them in Georgia is going to be an extremely difficult task to do one way or the other. And the Trump defense in this case is going to be far more broad reaching if he does it correctly than the kind of defense that he could try to raise in what I regard as the most serious of the charges, his effort to bulldoze Michael Pence into saying that I'm not going to count these ballots when he had no authority to do so.
That was even the Smith. That's the Smith case. That's not the Fulton County case.
That's the J. Smith case, the big one. There's also the Mar-a-Lago case, which I regard as less important because the stakes are lower. But nothing at Mar-a-Lago threatens the foundations of democracy.
A detail, Professor, I heard you and John New exchanging, and your analysis is that when there is a remark such as the one to the Georgia official, and it's not clear which way to interpret it, because it's a criminal case, you must take the most innocent interpretation. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, that's the one, the so-called rule of lenity. In this case, it's certainly a factor, but if you actually read the conversation through, Trump is convinced that there's been some stuff. And so then when you start looking at the over record, I still remember at the time there was this mysterious shutdown that took place in the county in Fulton County because of a water leak in which the Democratic operatives remained in the room and everybody else was vacated. So if you're Donald Trump, but you're going to go in and say, you found that that was perfectly innocent. You found that there were no ballots that were taken. But we're entitled in a situation where you're charging me with corrupting democracy to say I had the good faith belief that it was true. And the way I'm going to show you that I have a good faith proof is I'm going to show you all the reasons why it is that this is a plausible allegation. And so I don't see how she could run this trial if it turns out that what he does is to make a credible case that he was rightfully miffed that the things had been irregular. And it doesn't have to be that he's right. It doesn't have to be that it would change the count. All it has to be, in my view, is something that is a reasonable assertion that you can make on the basis of available facts. And generally speaking, this is a serious issue because the chain of custody problems in a COVID election were very serious. There were ballots that were mailed out that weren't returned, that could be harvested. There were drop-off points in which you could add or take ballots out. All of these issues increase the kind of uncertainty. None of these things make the slightest difference in the J6 case that we have, because that's the question of whether one man unilaterally who has the right to open but not even to count the ballots can set aside an entire election.
Would you say right now, Professor, that the Fulton County case is nowhere near the caliber of the case in D.C. about January 6th. To compare those two, just those two.
One of them is on a high level. I mean, you have to have a question of exactly what went on in the J6 case. Was it persuasion or was it coercion? Very hard question to answer. But I don't see anything in the Georgia case that merits the kind of charges and fanfare that was given. And this is starting at the center. And if that thing isn't there, and there is not a criminal exercise to tip an election illegally, but a desperate effort on the part of some very aggrieved politicians to say that there was a miscount that you have to correct, it is not a violation of the Constitution to argue that an election was improperly decided. And there's an extremely strong First Amendment defense with respect to that, even if ultimately Trump is false. But if you're Trump, you do not rely just on the First Amendment. This is strictly a belt and suspenders operation. What you also try to do is to explain why it is that he had very strong reasons to believe that. And I mean, I recall during the time, there were all sorts of people who made claims that were similar to the ones that Trump is making. And all he has to do is exhume those people and put them on the stand. So this is not going to be a case in which he just simply has to deny things. It's going to be a case in which he can make his own affirmative case. And that means there's going to be a lot more preparation in this case, even if we get rid of all the other kinds of motions that are going to start to happen. And I don't know what they are, but I will give you essentially the lawyer's truth about all complex procedures. Most of the iceberg lies beneath the surface of the water. And it consists in all sorts of pretrial motions on 1,000 different topics on which there could be genuine points of disagreement. And these all take time to resolve. Most of them are not appealable. Maybe one or two of them will be. But the idea that somehow or other, in a case of this magnitude, which she made it this broad, right? Smith tried to narrow the thing down, that she could compress this into a situation where she could start the trial, most conveniently the day when the Super Tuesday primaries start to take place. I think it's a little bit fanciful. So if somebody wants to say it looks to them like a political prosecution, I do. And let me just add one other thing. People have talked about the fact that there's no possibility of him getting a pardon under Georgia law, which is correct under Georgia law. But if this man is elected, and this is not my candidate, as president of the United States, and he has a duty to take care that the law is faithfully executed, the Georgia law necessarily has to be put aside, and the federal duty will prevail under the supremacy clause. So I think, in effect, that they can keep him in jail. If he's president of the United States, they can't put him in a padded cell. And he can't run his duties. And the states can be told as follows: you really want to put Mr. Trump in jail for 10 years? When he's done with his term of office, you could then try to reinstate that particular situation. But I don't believe, in effect, that Georgia can do this unilaterally. Because as you already know, people in Arizona say, hey, you know, he makes similar charges here. Well, let's file a case against him in this particular state as well. They don't have a Raffensperger conversation, perhaps. But it turns out it doesn't take very much to get a prosecution going. And what you can do, essentially, is to understand that the mere fact of bringing a lawsuit is a deadly worry to anybody who gets it. If somebody was to sue me tomorrow for something that's totally groundless, the fact that I know I'm going to win this case to 99% probability would still leave me quaking in my boots, because I'd be worried about how long this will take, what it's going to do to my reputation, how many resources it's going to take. Lawsuits are a form of aggression, which is why it is that you have to make sure that they're carefully cabined in so that they don't become abusive. I regard the suit that Ms. Willis has brought not as some great salvation, but as a serious overstepping of appropriate boundaries in cases of this sort.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, speaking of the case in Fulton County, the most recent allegation against the president. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.